Welcome for everyone to tonight's special Corps volunteer training. Jerry Hinkle, our research coordinator, the very recent research that supports advocacy of HR 763, the Energy Innovation Act, on two fronts. The first is a new paper that you can see here featured actually on the slide in Nature Climate Change, led by Dr. Noah Kaufman's team, that shows the baseline carbon prices estimated to achieve net zero carbon dioxide emissions in the US by mid-century. And the second study by Schindel et al. Shows how it will generate $700 billion annually in US health benefits alone, so that that bill pays for itself many times over on day one. If we've done our job well, after tonight's training, you'll be moved forward arm in arm with the peer-reviewed economics literature community, getting on the same page about what everyone is saying, why they're saying it, and as the details get added upon, being able to arm yourself with helpful resources. Our speaker tonight is going to help you understand why economists see carbon fee and dividend policies as good for the economy, explain how the Energy Innovation Act corrects prices so that this policy benefits greatly exceed this policy costs, and highlight the shift in economic support based on recent peer-reviewed literature and their rationale. To get us there, our speaker tonight is none other than the wonderful Jerry Hinkle. As an economist, Jerry has long believed that using the market by pricing carbon would be required to adequately address climate change. Jerry began giving public presentations on the risk of climate change in 2001 and lobbying Congress for strong policy in 2006. He's worked as a volunteer on climate issues for a wide variety of national nonprofits in the environmental space, as well as starting Citizens Climate Lobby's Presenters and Schedulers Action Team. He's been the Northern California coordinator with CCL for 6 years and also serves on CCL's board of directors for the last 2 years. Professionally, Jerry has worked as an economist in banking for 35 years and holds MA degrees in economics and in climate policy, as well as publishing several articles in these areas. Our agenda tonight is very straightforward. I'll pass the baton to you, Jerry, in just one moment, and we'll review why economists support this policy, the policy health co-benefits behind it, as well as the climate benefits, and then close on discussing the net policy benefits, all from the economics literature.
So I want to go over two questions with you. And the first one is the baseline carbon price in the Energy Innovation Act adequate to meet science-based emission reduction targets? And we're fortunate that some very recent research has come out. I don't even think the journal article's been published yet, but from Noah Kaufman and the people that he is doing research with. And it answers this question explicitly. In fact, what they're looking at is what US carbon price would be required for the US to go to net zero CO2 emissions by three different points in time, 2040, 2050, and 2060. So this is the summary results. And so on the left, you see the emission pathways to get to zero CO2 emissions in those three different years. And I want to focus on the blue one, because this is where the HR 763 targets were for 2050. Okay. And then we go to the right, and we'll see in the bars, the light blue bar is the one that represents the estimate of what carbon prices would need to be at two different points in time, right? 2025 and 2030, in order to be on this path to get to net zero, in this case by 2050. I want to point three things out about the blue bars. Okay, the first one is that it's a range, it's not a point. And in particular, the range is 34 to 64 for the in the year 2025, and then 74 to 124 in the year 2030. And it's a range because there's significant uncertainty in this modeling. And so NOAA's doing a great job of reflecting that uncertainty in the graph. In fact, and I think, well, the paper itself is linked in the slide, so you can read it for yourself. He does a great job of not only describing the different sources of uncertainty, but actually quantifying I learned a lot from it. So that's number one. Number two that I think is quite interesting is he only takes prices out to 2030. So what he stated the question to be is what would it take to get to net zero by 2050? But he only gives you prices to 2030. And increasingly you're seeing this in the literature because the feeling is the estimation of how much a carbon price will reduce emissions is really only reliable for about 10 years, maybe 15. But after that, it's a real guessing game. So don't go out that far. Don't go beyond 2030. Go to that point, and then he's suggesting that the policymakers reevaluate the impact of the carbon price at that point to see if at 2030, if the price needs to grow slowly, if it needs to grow more quickly in order to hit the target. He's really suggesting that we focus on the desirable emission reductions to drive the policy and to drive the carbon price. Okay, the third thing, and most important thing I want to point out here is that the EICDA baseline carbon price just nails this. It's right in between. It's right in the middle of the graphic for both 2025 and 2030. So the average price for 2025 is about $50 a ton. Our bill, were it to begin implementation in 2021, would be $55 a ton in 2025. Perfect. In 2030, it would be $105. Just a bit over the midpoint of the blue graph there. So the point is, look, we don't know what's going to happen next year in terms of the type of policy that's introduced. We're very much hopeful that something very much like our policy is introduced on a bipartisan basis. But you're in your advocacy, you can feel really good that the baseline carbon price that we're advocating for is very consistent with science-based targets. So that pertains to if our bill, you know, US only carbon price. But a question that a lot of volunteers are asking surrounds the fact that climate change is not a domestic phenomenon, but very much a global one. What if we passed our policy, it inspired global action, and the rest of the world were to adopt our carbon price? What would be the global impact? Would it be sufficient? And this is it's a paper actually that came out 3 years ago. And the question was, what global carbon price would be necessary for us to reach the 2C target? The UN put together what they called the High Level Commission on Carbon Prices. It was chaired by some of the absolutely most notable climate economists in the business, Nobel Prize winner Joseph Stiglitz, Sir Nicholas Stern, who was the primary author of the Stern Review. And if you look down at the bottom of the screen there, Adele Morris of Brookings Institute, I like to point her out, she is on our advisory, the advisory board. Yeah. So top level climate economists globally. They did a broad survey of the literature. They really sorted it out by what they saw to be the most credible. And let me show you the results that they came up with.
Go ahead.
So here's the slide that shows necessary prices a little further out by 2050. They also gave explicit global prices, very consistent with ours, to 2030 and said reevaluate at that point. Really similar to NOAA's message. But they said the models that informed those prices did give information on what they would need to be further out. So I draw your attention to the SSP2 line here. Okay, that's the expected scenario in terms of global growth, global energy use, okay? And the five symbols there on that line indicate the results of five different top peer-reviewed models. And what you'll see is that by 2050, there's a bit of an aggregation around $200 a ton. Okay, so it's probably safe to say that most of the models felt $200 a ton by 2050 would be sufficient to reach the 2C target. Now, this is 2005 prices, so we've got to bump them up about a third. So about 265, 270 a ton is what they're saying they think is adequate. Okay. Where would EICDA be at that point in time? A little over $300 a ton. So again, my summary point here is that if our bill were to pass and were to inspire global action in almost a mirror image, if you will, if our baseline carbon price were to be adopted globally, it would be sufficient, according to the best analysis that we have, to meet this very important science-based target. So again, I think you can feel very good about what you're advocating for. Second point, I think we understand, we've certainly tried to get this message out, economists broadly from across the political spectrum support a carbon price, and especially one in which all the funds go back into the economy, and many support carbon fee and dividend. And I want to try to explain to you why that is, so that it empowers your advocacy, so that you can walk out in your conversations with real confidence about why we're clear this is good for the economy, this is good for society. Because when the rubber meets the road, when the going gets tough out there, we're likely to hear once again, oh, it's a job killer, oh, it's bad for the economy. And I want you to know that is not what the peer-reviewed literature says. The peer-reviewed literature says putting a price on carbon and returning all the funds is good for the economy and society. So how I want to show you that here is to compare policy benefits for HR 763 and policy costs. Okay, so benefits, climate benefits, health benefits, regulatory benefits, which I won't try to quantify. Policy costs, there are costs, there are economic costs, we'll talk about that, and there are administrative costs of this type of policy. And I think it's really valuable that we can get some specifics around these. Go ahead, Brett, let's talk about benefits. Let's talk about costs first. So this is in NOAA's December 5th testimony to the Energy and Commerce. It comes from research done a couple years ago. And what we have here is GDP currently, and in this case it was 2016, that's the black bar. And then GDP under a no policy scenario, what he calls current policy, and then five different revenue neutral carbon taxes. And so NOAA's taking a look at this. He's showing the Congress people the visual, and he's coming up with this conclusion. Studies suggest roughly zero impacts on the overall growth of the US economy. Roughly no economic cost to our policy. This is a really important point. Okay, now I want to get a little bit more specific. So it turns out that a revenue neutral carbon tax, when the money goes back to reduce taxes, it's more stimulative. It's better for economic growth. And you see that here. So under current policy, in 10 years time, GDP is 27,653. The next three bars represent different payroll tax swaps, where the money goes, the carbon tax raises funds and it all goes to reducing payroll taxes. Okay, and what you'll see here is that there's a slight increase in GDP. Okay, next is our policy. And so it says $50 a ton equal rebates. That's the fee raises funds, they all go back to household in equal proportions. And there's a very slight reduction in GDP, about $100 billion. Okay, and this is in 10 years' time. Okay, so and this is consistent with what we know. Our policy, it turns out, is not quite as good for the economy, but it's much better for the poor. And that's why we've chosen to embrace it. So economic cost, but really pretty slight. In 10 years' time, about $100 billion, according to this model. Now, again, very recent research. This had not come out until the testimony on August 5th, 2020. This is from Dr. Drew Schindel. So bottom line is this: air pollution is nasty and it causes significant health issues, and those are very expensive, okay? And a policy like ours that will significantly reduce emissions will also significantly reduce that air pollution, and this generates significant co-benefits. And it also turns out we'd long had the sense that the reduction of that air pollution was more valuable than we had estimated. And finally, they were able to enhance models and really get a better picture of the degree to which a policy like ours would generate what we call health co-benefits. And this was provided for the first time to the House Oversight Committee on August 5th. Go ahead to the next slide. I'll give you the bottom line on these. So a policy like ours would avoid in the US 90,000 premature deaths a year. The prior estimate was 36,000. So, you know, a doubling to tripling of premature deaths avoided. 70,000 hospitalizations a year avoided. 6 million lost workdays a year avoided. That's over a 50-year period. And he's able to value these co-benefits at $700 billion a year. So the estimate had been $250 billion a year. It's now almost triple that. What this tells us, and you may have seen this because there was much press about this testimony. Our legislation pays for itself day one. Okay, in health benefits alone, if you put climate benefits aside, this thing pays for itself. So clearly good for society, clearly good for the economy. So let me move on to climate benefits. Now, the big old asterisk disclaimer here. These are old. It's as close to an official estimate as we have of the value of climate benefits. I almost didn't want to pull it out because it's so conservative. These are being updated. To be frank with you, under the Trump administration, it was not a priority to revise these. They're being revised through intensive work by the University of Chicago and a consortium of other really top organizations. But here's what we got for now. So again, in 10 years' time, according to RFF's model, our bill is going to reduce about 2.18 billion tons of greenhouse gas emissions a year. They're valued very conservatively from data from 2010 and 2016 by the EPA at $52 a ton. The new estimate coming out next year, my guess is this number will at least double, but we'll have to see. It's coming out in about 6 months. For total climate benefit of $113 billion a year. So what I want to show you is the policy benefits swamp, overwhelm, are far greater than the policy costs. I calculated from the analysis that NOAA had showed you, the $98 billion reduction in GDP, a $5 billion is our estimate of the approximate administrative costs of our bill. So the benefits are roughly in this calculation 8 times the costs. This policy will make society and the economy better. So one note, when NOAA shows his estimate there, that model does not show the economic impact of the climate climate benefits or the health benefits. So it's greatly understating, or it's overstating economic costs. The picture is far better than that. So this is why, and I'll show this every presentation I ever give. This is from a January 2019 op-ed in the Wall Street Journal. It's a statement of support. It's considered the largest economist statement of support ever generated. Over 3,500 economists, including the top names, all former chair of the Federal Reserve, Greenspan on the right, Janet Yellen on the left, really from across the political spectrum, 27 Nobel Prize winners, top economists, and really what they're saying is CFND explicitly in this instance is the best way to address climate change. And what I've tried to do there is to explain to you why economists so nearly universally support a carbon price and a revenue neutral carbon tax. I want to show you that now in comparison with other revenue neutral carbon taxes. So what we've got here is the first one, the light blue, money goes to deficit reduction. The second one, it goes to reduce payroll taxes. The third one goes to reduce corporate taxes. And the yellow bars reflect a policy in which money comes back to households, as in our policy. This is the y-axis concerns tax burden. So in other words, if your tax burden is lowered, that's a good thing. It's only CFND. It's only when money comes back to households directly that those most vulnerable in society are benefited by the policy. The other forms of revenue neutral carbon tax don't get you there. They're largely flat. This, by the way, is also from NOAA's December 5th testimony to Energy and Commerce. This is all on our website. The laser talks, as Rick pointed out, are on the main website. Scroll to the bottom. Secondly, I want to point out to you, the Economics Policy Network Action Team has a page on CCL Community. I've got the link here. Go to the EPN. The blogs, both on Schindel's paper on health co-benefits and on NOAA's recent paper, will be up, my guess is, in the next couple of weeks. They're not there now. But this is the site that will really provide for you details and the literature behind our case. The economics is a really strong case. The economic argument for our bill, this is very good policy, folks. I'll stop there.
Jerry, thank you so much for the great news tonight. I know we're all in need of it, and this is really inspiring just to get a great summary of all of these different places and sources we can cite in our own advocacy. Well, on that note, I know that I speak for everyone on the line here. Thank you so much, Rick. Thank you so much, Jerry. Both of your work and just the larger team that really made this analysis possible to get in front of us is very much appreciated. So with that, it's just so wonderful to see everyone's faces tonight. I'm going to unmute all lines, and we wish you all well. Stay safe out there, everyone.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Citizens Climate Lobby's training program. You can tune into more episodes anywhere podcasts are available. Inspired by what you heard today? Join Citizens Climate Lobby to advocate for bipartisan climate solutions. Go to community.citizensclimate.org to find more trainings, resources, your local chapter, national action teams, discussion forums, and more. Be sure to like our Facebook page and follow us on Twitter and Instagram at Citizens Climate. We also invite all of our listeners to subscribe to our YouTube channel for more inspiration. And together, we are creating the political will for a livable world.